From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, first, Netflix lost The Office to a new streaming rival. Now another new competitor is taking away Friends. Then how Kumail Nanjiani inserted subtle themes of toxic masculinity in the buddy cop action comedy, Stuber.
I was like, if we're doing a movie in 2019 about angry dudes with guns, I think this is a great way to talk about that stuff in a movie that's traditionally a very, like, man movie.
And the documentary Sea of Shadows chronicles how drug cartels are contributing to a marine life disaster in Baja California. All that coming up on The Frame. We've got some news today about another popular TV series that is leaving Netflix. That's right. If you're a Netflix user, pretty soon the gang from Friends will not be there for you. The popular sitcom is moving to the new streaming service that Warner Media is set to launch late this year called HBO Max. It's another in an ever-growing list of new streaming sites being created as content creators try to match Netflix in the streaming wars. So how does Netflix grow its business without now two of its top shows having already lost The Office? For more, we have Joe Flint. He's a media and entertainment reporter for The Wall Street Journal. So Netflix's two most popular shows are reruns of Friends and The Office. So help us understand how much those shows might have been worth to Netflix and what might be driving the other companies to bring them back to their new streaming sites.
Well, for Netflix, The Office and Friends have been very, very important, surprisingly strong performers for them. I don't think when they bought those shows initially, they anticipated that they would be. And it's interesting. I mean, I think, you know, to use an analogy, I sort of view those shows as kind of like going into a supermarket. Friends and The Office maybe get you to sample other products at Netflix, just like when you go to the supermarket, you put the new products next to the Coca-Cola and the Heinz ketchup so that you'll see them and go, hey, what about this? That's kind of the role a lot of these older shows play. They're comfort food. They're there for people to graze and stay on the site and hopefully then go experience new shows. This is why, of course, Warner and NBC Universal, which are both launching their own streaming services next year, wanted them back. And they're paying large prices to do that. They don't get them cheap just because they own them.
Well, you raised two points. And one is the whole idea of kind of what in the grocery world is called the loss leader, that Warner Media and NBC Universal might actually lose money on these deals, but they could draw subscribers to their new platforms because those would be the only places you could see the series.
I think that may be. I mean, you know, to be clear, reruns of Friends and The Office will live on cable for a long time. But younger viewers, as we know, they cut the cord or never bought the cord in the first place. So for them, those are the homes for those shows, these streaming services. And from the business side, they are taking a risk. Warner Brothers used to get a big check from Netflix, as did NBC Universal. They're going to have to hope that that pays off in terms of encouraging people to subscribe to their sites and whether the marketplace can stand four or five major streaming services. We'll find out in the next decade or so.
Yeah, and that seems to be part of what looks like could be an issue down the line. So if you like Friends, you're going to need an HBO Max account. If you like The Office, you'll need NBC Universal's new streaming platform. Let's say you're addicted to Handmaid's Tale. You'll need Hulu. You're obsessed with Stranger Things. You need Netflix. But at this point, what you really need is a second mortgage to afford all of that. Isn't that going to be a problem down the line?
It may be. And that's the funny thing. All these streaming services were seen as, for consumers, a great thing. It would eliminate the need for the big cable bundle that we've all subscribed to for all these years. But ultimately, this is a new bundle. And the other part of the equation you didn't touch on, but live sports. If you're a big sports fan, football, baseball, basketball, you're most likely still going to need that cable or satellite subscription to get your fix. So, you know, ultimately, all these things that are meant to maybe save money and give consumers more choice, somehow it never seems to end up working that way.
So I think there's another way, too, to look at the Friends and Office deals, and that is, not that long ago, content creators like NBC Universal, Disney, and Warner Media looked at Netflix as an ancillary market, the way that Blockbuster Video used to be for movies, and now they recognize that not only had they created a great competitor, but it was probably important to claw these programs back. So where does that leave Netflix, which is spending billions of dollars on original content? Is its future going to be tied to the shows that it makes rather than licensing other studios' content?
More and more, that's going to be the case for Netflix. And you know, if there's a plus side to losing The Office and losing Friends, and they'll be losing other shows down the road, Disney will claw back a lot of their shows, is that money will, in theory, be freed up to invest even more in original content. But yeah, you know, the challenge for Netflix is, I mean, they do have a lot of successful original content and movies, but for all that, they create so much content, and a lot of it doesn't seem to make a blip or register. I learn about shows that Netflix has canceled that I never even knew were on the service. And yeah, that's going to be one of their challenges. They have so much original programming, and in theory, they're going to be making more and more of it, that they're going to have to find more and better ways to market and promote it.
Yeah, I know that shows like Friends and Office have a following, and if you're launching a new series, you got to do a lot of marketing to get it noticed. And the other thing I wonder about, too, is that we're talking about multi-year deals. And part of me thinks that this is like a sports team that's signing a veteran to a really long contract. Will people really care about Friends or The Office 3 or 4 or 5 years down the line?
That's an interesting question. I'm certainly surprised at the longevity these shows have shown. I think there's something about, I don't want to turn into a sociologist here, but I think there's something about those two shows in particular that has been attractive to younger viewers who didn't watch them the first go around. They're both, you know, relatively friendly, happy shows, and it's interesting. I'm a huge Seinfeld fan, but it's funny. I don't think Seinfeld resonates the same way with a Gen Z or millennials because, you know, Seinfeld had such a nasty streak to it, which doesn't seem to resonate the same way.
Joe Flint is a media and entertainment reporter at The Wall Street Journal. Joe, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Coming up on The Frame, Kumail Nanjiani puts a spin on the mismatched buddy film In Stuber. After actor and screenwriter Kumail Nanjiani's 2017 breakout film, The Big Sick, he was looking for an entirely different kind of role for a follow-up project. When he came across the script for Stuber, he recognized an opportunity to stretch himself and the themes of the movie. The way Nanjiani saw it, Stuber could be more than your average action-packed buddy cop comedy. Jen Yamato of the LA Times was my co-host for The Frame Summer Movie Preview, and that's when we chatted with Nanjiani. He began by explaining the premise of Stuber, which co-stars Dave Bautista as a policeman.
An Uber driver gets kidnapped by a cop and forced to go on an all-night adventure to catch a murderous drug dealer. And the cop can't see.
Because he just got LASIK.
He just got LASIK. That's the thing. I don't know why it's not in the trailers. The cop just got LASIK. And so there's like, over the course of the whole movie, he's got this eye chart that he's staring at, waiting for it to get unblurry.
So I'm curious how this came about. Were you looking for something like this?
After The Big Sick, I sort of had a little bit of paralysis about what to do next. So I decided that the only way I wouldn't put too much pressure on myself was to do something completely different that nobody could compare to The Big Sick, right? And so I kind of was like, I want to do like a big studio action comedy type movie. So then this script came in and I read it and I thought it was really fun and funny. But I was like, if I want to do like an action comedy with guns and all this stuff, there has to be a reason for it to exist. Like it can't just be that it's entertaining. And so I actually talked to Fox a bunch about it and was like, hey, I think there's some like underlying themes in this movie that I think we should really bring up to the surface. And if you guys are willing to do that, then I think this could be a cool thing to do. We'd be able to talk about things that you don't normally see in like a big action movie like this that seems like such a guy movie, you know?
Like toxic masculinity and men talking about their feelings.
Exactly. Exactly. I was like, if we're doing a movie in 2019 about angry dudes with guns, we have to talk about that. I feel like we're obviously in an era where, you know, masculinity is under the microscope and we're really sort of figuring out that most of the world's problems come from men who can't feel their feelings. So I was like, I think this is a great way to talk about that stuff in a movie that's traditionally a very, like, man movie.
And for people who don't know what Stuber means, what does Stuber mean, Camille?
So my character's name is Stu, and I drive an Uber, so my boss calls me Stuber to make fun of me, and it really gets under my skin.
You didn't cancel.
It affects my rating. I can't drop below 4 stars or I lose this job.
Ooh, new ride? It's not bad. How'd you afford this, Stuber?
You can stop calling me that.
But he really Stuber? Loves you.
Yeah. I think that's really fun, too, because we were like, let's take all the male types and deconstruct them. So this guy's sort of the, you know, the petty tyrant type of guy. And we do a scene where we deconstruct that, where he's just like kind of lonely and feels bad and insecure about himself.
Well, and you have a whole scene in a male strip club.
Yes, exactly. Steve Howey is the name of the guy that I talked to a bunch. And it's funny, he's got like a Hillary Clinton tattoo.
She was up by 12 points in August. I was all in.
We just wanted to take a bunch of different types of men and sort of deconstruct all of them.
No, and the stripper is talking about being honest with your feelings and, you know, not hiding.
You need to tell her how you feel. A relationship cannot thrive without honesty.
And, you know, he's been body shamed by his boss for being, like, you know, 1% body fat as opposed to 0.5.
Right, right. He looks great. By the way, I'll tell you, I felt very inadequate in that locker room because it's like 10 of the most gorgeous hunks. And then me, like, I noticed I watched this movie a bunch of times with different audiences. My posture is so much worse in that scene than any other scene in the movie.
We are talking with Kumail Nanjiani about Stuber. The matchup of you and Dave Bautista,
right?
You know, his persona, his outward appearance, like it lends itself to a deeper deconstruction along those lines.
That's what's interesting about him, is that he looks like such a brute. You know, he's so big and he looks like a scary guy, but he's the sweetest, most sincere man I have truly ever met. He is completely in touch with his emotions. In a way, our characters in the movie are kind of swapped. He's the one who's really comfortable being sincere and crying and really talking about his feelings, whereas I was the one who was really cut off from myself for a long time. And in the last 4 or 5 years, I've been sort of trying to do the work of getting in touch with my feelings and feeling comfortable expressing something other than anger, you know?
What is that about? I mean, is that about things that you think you can do through acting where you can start understanding yourself better?
Yeah. I mean, honestly, I started taking acting classes like a year before The Big Sick because I knew that I had to be able to access parts of myself that I hadn't been able to access. And in taking acting classes, it kind of was like therapy. I realized that for years, I didn't know how I was feeling, why I was angry about stuff. And so in doing acting work for The Big Sick, I realized, like, oh, there's a lot of stuff going on inside me that I thought was not good to feel. And so after The Big Sick, I continued doing that work on myself. Like, I cry at almost every movie now, and I went like 15 years without crying at all. When this movie came along, I was like, oh, I think this could be an interesting way to talk about some of the things that I've had to deal with on my own. When I was sort of talking to Fox about this movie, and I don't want to take credit for this movie in any way. All that stuff was in there. But I was like, I see these characters as one needs to get angry and one needs to cry.
So how do you do that and make what is a summer movie with, like, you know, I won't say car chases, but there's some car action. There's a ton of violence. There's a lot of, like, what we would see in a big action movie. How do you make sure that that is responsible as well, that you're not just kind of random gunplay, people are just getting mowed down because that's what you have to do in a summer movie?
I mean, that's tricky, right? That's tricky. So it is a shooting movie. It is people with guns. It is car chases. Those things happen in movie, and that's the language of this type of cinema. But I was like, my character should be anti-guns.
Take a shot! Shoot!
Just defeat him!
He's so little!
I was very adamant. I was like, if I hold a gun in this movie, I don't want to like feel cool or good about it. The only time I fire is once into the air. When we went to do the poster shoot for the movie, the concept was both of us holding guns, and I was like, I'm not going to hold a gun. That's completely not what this character is. So I'm honestly not trying to take a big stand against guns or anything. Obviously, I think gun control is very important, but, you know, Dave has a lot of guns, and he's a very responsible gun owner, and he's very comfortable around guns. I'm not comfortable around guns, so I thought that that perspective should be in there.
Can you describe the approach to making this such an L.A. movie as well?
We didn't shoot it in L.A.
We shot in Georgia, right?
We shot it in Atlanta, and then we did like a week here to cover the exteriors and stuff. But I think they just did an amazing job of finding places in Atlanta that looked like L.A. and then shooting enough of L.A. And what I like about it is that thing of like, oh, we got to get from here to here. That'll take about this time. So the math of all of it is right, too. Along with how long a car's battery lasts, you know?
An electric vehicle.
An electric vehicle's battery lasts.
Come on, start it up, let's go.
Oh, it's already started. Electric car. I call it silent but deadly.
Drive.
I'm Stu, how do you do? Can I get you some bottled water, some Canadian chocolates? It was one of those things where I thought I was getting 5 bars on Amazon, but I ended up getting
Koreatown, now.
Koreatown, now. Hold on, I'm gonna bang a Yui here real quick. Nope, don't got it. Hold on.
Well, and what Stuber has that none of the summer blockbusters, certainly the studio blockbusters, have are two leads like you and Dave Bautista. There is some really smart writing, I think, baked into the banter between your two characters about race and about perception. And it's handled so well, I think, especially when it comes to Dave Bautista, who not a lot of people know is of Filipino heritage.
Right.
And so I love that you guys are getting a summer berth for this.
I think what's interesting about it is, so my character has racist stuff happen to him, but through the course of the whole movie, he's trying to label other people too. Like there's a moment that happens in the back of a van towards the end of the movie where he's trying to explain to an Asian person what Uber is. And she's like, yeah, dude, we know what Uber is. So he's guilty of the same stuff that he's sort of the victim of, you know? So we wanted to sort of show that too.
It's clear that Uber was a willing participant in this movie. I mean, they are all over the film. And yet there are these jokes about the driver like, oh, my God, he took the right turn. It's now 4 minutes, not 2 minutes. How much freedom did you have to actually make fun of ride sharing services and Uber in particular?
First of all, they did not pay us any money for this. People think this is like an ad for Uber. I'd be like, this is a terrible ad for Uber, that the driver, like, you get kidnapped. How is this a positive thing for Uber? They wanted to make sure that the app was used correctly. That was their big thing. They wanted to make sure that technically everything we were doing in the movie would have happened that way in real life. They weren't too concerned about us making fun of Uber. Like, they were kind of cool with that, but they wanted to make sure that it was an accurate portrayal.
Kameo, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Kumail Nanjiani co-stars in Stuber. It opens on July 12th. Coming up on The Frame, the documentary Sea of Shadows involves fishing and drug cartels in the Sea of Cortez. If you've never heard of a small porpoise-like mammal called the vaquita, you're not alone. But sadly, the chances that future generations will learn about the mammal are slim at best. The nearly extinct vaquitas are a casualty of fishing nets in the Sea of Cortez off Baja California. The nets are there to capture a fish called the totoaba, whose dried swim bladders fetch a high price in Asia for their purported medicinal properties. The documentary Sea of Shadows examines not only the rapid eradication of the vaquita, but also the plight of local fishermen in San Felipe who've been targeted by the drug cartels who traffic the swim bladders as if they were cocaine. Sea of Shadows is in theaters this week, but it premiered earlier this year at the Sundance Film Festival, and that's where I spoke with the film's director, Richard Lotkani. He began by describing the small aquatic mammal that has become collateral damage in this struggle.
The vaquita is the smallest whale on Earth. It looks like, it's very cute, it looks like a cross between a panda bear and a dolphin. There's so few left of them. It's the first mammal that may go extinct in a decade. When we started, there were less than 30 left. Now, we believe there's less than 15 left, so they're really declining fast. But the vaquita is just a symbol for a much bigger story, which is that the drug cartels, the Mexican cartels and the Chinese mafia based in Tijuana, are attacking this habitat of the vaquita because they're looking for something else, the cocaine of the sea, the totoaba. And they like that so much because the swim bladder of this fish can fetch up to $100,000 in China. So they discovered it as an alternative to the drug trade. So this is why the story is so big and dangerous, because they're attacking an ocean that Jacques Cousteau called the aquarium of the world. And they are destroying it just to get this swim bladder. And nobody was looking. Like when we did the Ivory Game, the elephant crisis was known and it was a big deal. And, you know, everyone kind of loves elephants. This one was a silent war that no one knew about, but it was so deadly because tens and hundreds of thousands of animals were being killed and slaughtered. And that was 5 hours south of Los Angeles.
So, Richard, when I think about the challenges in making this movie, obviously, the first one is the vaquita. They're very few, they're hard to find, and they're certainly hard to document. And then you're working in an area where there are people who don't want you to document what's happening, and they don't want you interfering in their business. And those people are powerful, and they have guns. So what were the biggest challenges for you in trying to document what was going on outside of San Felipe?
The big challenge starts with that you need a lot of money to make a film like that, because just the security that goes into keeping us all safe, because every day that we spend there, we were noticed more and more. And we try to pretend to be like a natural history kind of film team, just doing a film on wildlife, right? But they were wondering, like, why are they on the Sea Shepherd ship, which is fighting the cartels, and why are they so interested in what's going on here? So yes, it became the most dangerous film I've ever done. I said that as well when I did the Ivory Game. They started sending us more clear messages that they do know who we are. And especially the really bad guy, Oscar Parra, started to let us know by sending us a messenger saying, why don't you interview me? But we were like, we're not going to do that, because he had actually just murdered a soldier in San Felipe like a few weeks back.
Caught on videotape too.
Caught on videotape. And we thought it could be a trap.
There's a moment in the film where you are filming a vaquita that is in distress. And to watch what is happening to this vaquita as your cameras are rolling and the marine biologists who are trying to care for it is unbelievably difficult to watch, because this is an animal that's not only almost extinct, it is in some ways kind of anthropomorphic, and it's an animal that has almost kind of human qualities in its face. Can you talk about, without revealing what happens in this scene, what it was like to film that sequence where you see this vaquita who is struggling to stay alive?
You know, it took 5 weeks of us being out there on 15 boats with 90 scientists who were the best in the world to try to find them. You know, for us, it was this journey, this roller coaster ride of emotions of being with the scientists looking for this animal, which they wanted to rescue. They wanted to extract all the vaquitas and put them into a safe zone so they can stay alive, because the thousands of ghost nets that were going in to catch the totoaba were killing everything. They're like walls of death. But yeah, being close to that vaquita that after 5 weeks was caught was incredible. It was the first time a vaquita was even filmed. Like, we were the first film team ever to film this animal in its entirety. That was like, oh my God. But then also watching it struggle with captivity, that was emotional, like you cannot believe. It was tears of joy first to actually find one, bring it to safety, but then also watching how it was struggling, it was a big roller coaster for us emotionally.
The vaquita, there's maybe a dozen of them left. What would you say to people who say, what difference does the vaquita make to the world?
You know, we have a responsibility, I think, to care and to not look away. And this story is remarkable because it is a small story, but it's a small story that you find over and over again across the world. And we have to care. And that's why I try to make films Like, they're not educational films at all. I try to make them entertaining. The thriller aspect comes from the danger, of course, but it also helps in telling a story like that because it's captivating and people may want to watch it that usually don't watch these kind of films. And I don't want to just make films for people who care anyway, you know? Like, I want everyone to start looking at this and say, like, this can't happen. Like, I can't allow this. I'm angry. I want to inspire especially the young people. Like, our hero, Jack, the drone pilot, he's 21 and he's risking his life every day and he's out there facing poachers and he's angry and he's not ready to accept. So he's fighting. And to show heroes like that, I think it is very inspiring and empowering for young people who I think do care a lot about our planet. And they should be shown what you can do, you know, and be inspired.
Richard, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
And that's the show for today. Remember, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. You'll find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn of the Moan Broadcast Center. We'll see you back here tomorrow.